Hello and welcome to the Investment Hour from the Investors Chronicle. At the end of week six of government lockdown, it feels like a long time since the UK government announced this.
We are collectively telling cafes, pubs, bars and restaurants to close tonight as soon as they reasonably can and not to open tomorrow.
It may have been a hectic 6 weeks for the Prime Minister, who has spent time in critical care in hospital, shaken off coronavirus and had a baby. But for the pubs, restaurants, retailers, gyms, travel and leisure companies, it has no doubt been a slow and painful month and a half.
Got no money coming in through the tills, which is not something that we'd ever planned for, as you can appreciate.
I'm John Heumann, and this week we're going to talk about the challenges facing companies as behaviour has changed during the coronavirus lockdown and what that might mean for huge sectors of the economy if those behavioural changes become permanent.
And I'm Megan Boxall, and we're going to be following the fallout from the behavioural changes up the chain. Talking to Emma Powell about the property industry.
Companies like Workspace, they only collected half their rent, and the chief exec there, actually, I spoke to him, he was saying that he expects, just because of the kind of supply-demand flipping now, that pricing is going to suffer going forward.
And Alex Newman about the difficulties in the banking sector.
The price-to-book value ratios of most banks are now at such incredibly depressed levels that, in a sense, it's harder to see how much lower they can go.
And while it's often said that sales are vanity and profit is sanity, I'll be talking to Phil Oakley to find out why understanding revenues matters more to investors than the old saying suggests.
The Investment Hour. 60 minutes of money with the Investors Chronicle.
So, John, 6 weeks. We're at the end of 7 weeks because the office closed a week before the government's official lockdown started. Starting to get a bit rough, to say the least. We're missing the pub. We're missing the office. And we're probably finding it a lot easier than the people who actually own those offices and pubs and shops and you name it. It's not easy. What's going on?
Well, we can still work. So, yeah, we are finding life a bit better because business carries on. But business has just stopped for lots and lots and lots of people in the hospitality space particularly, but retail as well. We have some numbers. We can see what the impact of COVID was in March on retail sales, and it's massive, and that was March. So as you say, this lockdown has been 6 weeks. Only two of them were in March, yet non-food sales in March were down 20%. Food sales were up 15%. So, you know, we already started to see that the kind of shifts in behaviour happening in that month. April is going to be much, much worse.
And April, the food sales might not be so good either, because people did a lot of stockpiling at the end of March. So we might not even have that part of the retail sector propping it up quite as much as it was in the first couple of weeks of lockdown.
Although maybe we've had a food delivery what seems like every other day, quite frankly. It took us a long time to get certain things. It took a long time until we could get any eggs, you know, and it's still quite difficult to get delivery slots. Which is why we sort of take them opportunistically as we can. Things are not back to normal. Things are not back to normal. And I've also, my local brewery has run out of Puck's Folly, which is really annoying. I think we have had a rough month, and people are getting to the end of their tether. We heard from Tim Martin at the beginning there. There is a desire to get things moving again. Particularly from people like Mr. Martin, Mike Ashley at Fraser's Group, which was Sports Direct. They want to get opening. They are ringing the bell for business.
It's interesting that those two characters, I mean, they are big characters in particular, they are saying we need to get back, we need to get going again. But if those two, those are big companies, Fraser's and Wetherspoons, but if they're struggling, how are the smaller companies, the privately owned companies, the people who own their own family businesses? That's really, really tough for them. And as lockdown maybe starts to get lifted in the next couple of weeks, we might start to really see the real impact on what the lockdown has meant for such big areas of the UK economy.
Yeah, I mean, you can only speculate how hard this is for a small retailer or a small restaurant owner. You know, those businesses are tough to run at the best of times, tough to make money from at the best of times. And this is the worst of times. We're seeing some numbers from some very large retailers And, you know, people like Marks and Spencer and Next, who came out with a very, very detailed update and basically scenario planning and how bad this can get. And it's saying things are even worse than it expected. They're likely to be even worse than it expected. Marks and Spencer's cut its final dividend. And they're all taking advantage of the kind of rate relief that the government has offered. You know, there are schemes, but nevertheless, things are still really, really tough, even for the very largest businesses like Next and Marks and Spencer.
It's not good when companies like that are reporting such dire numbers, and they are. They're really, really dire. And the other side of things, which has shifted very rapidly because of the lockdown and coronavirus, is the way we're working. And we've had US tech results in the last few days, and they really show how rapidly the change in the way we work has happened. I mean, Microsoft's numbers were ridiculous. They reported something like a 700% increase in the use of Teams in Italy because everyone's working from home. Everyone's having to use it. And that's what we're using right now. We're using Google Hangouts. Everyone's using this work from home software. So these software companies, yeah, fine, they're doing well. But yeah, it means that we're not going into the office. We're not using the local shops, the local cafes, the local pubs, and how soon is it going to be before we are starting to use those again? Because it doesn't look like we're going back into the office anytime soon.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I was walking up the high street today, and lots of businesses, lots of restaurants have been shut. I saw one today had actually finally succumbed to opening itself up for delivery. So I think, you know, everybody is reaching the point where they're thinking we've got to get going. I mean, we did see something from the US. This week there was some drug trial data from Gilead, which has sort of made everyone a little bit optimistic that there is some light at the end of the tunnel here, and that actually, you know, there may be some kind of solution which helps us get out the house a bit quicker. We might be hearing from Boris Johnson later about what the government's lockdown plans are.
By the time you listen to this, we may have already heard what Boris Johnson's plans are. Yeah, obviously we're recording on Thursday afternoon, and Boris Johnson is back at work, back at the office today after his difficult few weeks. But yeah, I mean, if there hasn't been an update yet, there's going to have to be. It's the 7th of May, which was the next legal time that the government has to update on what the lockdown is. And yeah, like you say, I think people are reaching the end of their tether. And yeah, the fact that we're seeing retailers and, well, the food companies starting to go back and offer takeaway services shows that they're really now having to say, right, you know what, if your health is okay, you need to come back and help us out here, because there isn't going to be a company left at the end of this. And those are the decisions that 6 weeks ago, that those companies have had the option to remain open this whole time, but they have made those decisions based on the health of their employees and their staff. But actually, those staff may not have a job if they don't start running something, getting some money through the tills, as Tim Martin says, sometime soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I would like the pub to open sometime soon. And all those restaurants, I would like to give them my money. I'm sure they would like to get back to normal. I'm sure their landlords would like them to get back to normal as well. There's a whole knock-on effect of me not spending my money in a pub or in a restaurant or in the local retailer, and we're going to hear about that now, aren't we?
Yeah. And with that said, we'll go to the next stage up the chain and talk to Emma Powell about what the lack of spending means for the commercial landlords. Hi, Emma. Thanks very much for joining us. So, obviously, the decline in the high street is something that's been happening for a while, and it's something that has been having a knock-on effect on the commercial landlords, which rent that space to the retailers on the high street. But all those trends have been accelerated, obviously, with the lockdown. So what is the impact that is having on the commercial landlords which are renting high street space right now?
Yeah, well, like you said, this has really been kind of catalyst for an existing trend for a lot of the kind of high street landlords. Obviously, we've had this moratorium on evictions until the 30th of June, which could be extended. And also more recently, a ban on statutory demands and winding up orders. So for landlords, really, during the end of March, beginning of April, when they were collecting rent for the second quarter, obviously a lot of the retail landlords saw a big drop in collections. I mean, I think it was under 30%. For Hammerson, it was just over 30%. So a huge drop. I suppose what would be more interesting to see is, during the next quarter collection date, whether that picks up at all or or whether the kind of financial strain on a lot of these retailers who obviously weren't in a great financial position before any of this started, whether that kind of means that they can't really afford to pay their rent again. So, you know, landlords have to look at deferrals or switching to monthly repayments, or I suppose, you know, what kind of legal protection they have at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it is a really interesting point there, especially at the point about the moratorium. So obviously some of these retailers are being protected from the fact that they currently haven't got any money coming in. But then that is feeding back up the chain to these landlords who, like, where do they go if their tenants aren't paying them? And what support are they getting, if any?
There's not a lot they can do, to be honest. And it's been a bit of a bugbear for a lot of landlords who, when you speak to them, say, well, obviously we understand that, you know, our tenants, they've shut their businesses. They're not getting any revenue in at the moment. We understand, obviously, you know, we're willing to work with them. But something else a lot of landlords that I've spoken to have said, well, we're also actually trying to, you know, figure out which are the ones we should support and which actually their owners, their backers, some of them have got huge investors, they should be footing the bill for some of this. So I think that's also something landlords, you know, they're not just going to accept, you know, all of their tenants saying, oh, we can't afford to pay at the moment. It's rightly so, a lot of the retailers obviously have got this support legally, but for a landlord, you're in a very difficult position.
Yeah, and potentially not something that's going to get any easier. As you say, this is a trend that's been happening for a while, and coronavirus has accelerated it. But at the end of this, there might be lots of vacancies. There might be businesses which just can't fill the space because they've gone out of business. So then what? Is there a worry that landlords just aren't going to be able to fill their retail space?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you look at it even before coronavirus, even before the outbreak, rental values were falling across the retail market. And some landlords were thinking, well, what can we do in terms of change of use? But because of planning regulation, that's not so easy in terms of kind of switching your high street or your shopping centre locations to residential and stuff. That's actually quite hard. I think it seems inevitable there'll be an increase in vacancies and therefore further decline in rental values. Because you know what, if people aren't taking the space, then you've got to drop your price, haven't you?
Yeah. And then, so how about then the another side of the commercial property market, the office rental space? And that's a trend which maybe has come about far quicker than, or changed rapidly because of coronavirus. Obviously, the retail thing was already something that was happening, but a shift in demand for office space feels like it's something quite new. Obviously, all of a sudden, we're not having to go into the office very much at the moment. How are the office landlords coping with that?
Yeah, that's a tricky one as well, because obviously, yeah, like you say, I mean, just like us, we can work from home. You've got Zoom, you've got all the tools to do that. Do I need, as an employer, to rent out fancy office space in the middle of London at quite a large cost? Well, perhaps not. Perhaps I can take less space. The other side of, I suppose, the immediate impact we've seen now is, you know, all the office landlords have suffered a decline in second quarter rental collections because they've also got the likes of New Look and all these kind of fast fashion and retail companies who obviously are under strain themselves. So they've had to ask for, you know, rent deferrals and things like that. I mean, they're better placed than the retailers, obviously, but again, it seems inevitable there will be a bit of a reevaluation by companies, which could also feed through to decline in pricing, perhaps, you know, decline in the amount they're able to charge for space.
The section of that market which is really interesting is the flexible office space, which we were seeing such a massively high demand for space like WeWork, and now all of a sudden that might not be something that's happening so much in the future. How are the landlords coping with that change?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? It's crazy. Actually, I read a stat that flexible office space accounted for about a quarter of the total London office market last year. It was the biggest proportion of take-up among any other sector for the first time. And that's obviously really been fed by kind of WeWork and a lot of the established landlords actually trying to get into that market to compete. I suppose the flip side of flexible workspace, and obviously it was popular with businesses, is that, like you kind of mentioned, it's very easy just to hand the keys back, right? You're on a very flexible lease. There was a survey out, actually, I think it came out this week, that mentioned that inquiries were down about half, unsurprisingly, at the moment. And obviously rental collections for companies like Workspace, which actually owns the freehold, which kind of sets it apart from a WeWork or an IWG. They only collected half their rent. And the chief exec there, actually, I spoke to him, he was saying that he expects, just because of the kind of supply-demand flipping now, that pricing is going to suffer going forward, which again seems inevitable, doesn't it?
Yeah. So is it a sector that we should be steering clear of completely as investors, or are there any companies which look like they might be weathering the storm?
Yeah, some of them are actually doing quite well. Like, the key with all these landlords is obviously looking at their loan to value ratios. Like, that starts creeping up a lot, that's a warning sign. Looking at interest cover, because obviously they've got to meet their own kind of finance costs through the rent that they're receiving, so high interest cover is great. And also, I suppose another thing you want to look at is the amount of development risk they've got. So not all the office providers do a lot of big developments, because obviously the risk of, you know, doing a lot of developments is, are they going to be the takers when I've finished? So I think like CLS is quite a good one. Doesn't do a lot of development. It's got kind of spread across France, Germany, UK. Collected about 87% of its rent during the second quarter, which isn't actually bad. That's better than most of them. Low loan to value ratio and quite a lot of cash, actually, because they made loads of disposals last year, actually thinking they were going to go out and acquire a lot of assets this year, which obviously isn't happening. So they're quite a good one. Another good one is Derwent, actually, mainly because it's got, again, very low loan to value ratio. I think it's about 16%, which is among the lowest you'll see in any sector in real estate. Very good quality stock. And I mean, like all, most of the kind of real estate shares has been sold off pretty heavily. So we actually included Derwent in one of our kind of wish list shares recently, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, quality definitely seems to be key at the moment. Quality and cash. Thanks very much, Emma. Really good to unravel some of what's going on in a difficult market to understand.
No worries.
So we've heard from Emma Powell about some of the pain that's being experienced in the property industry. Now we're going to speak to Alex Newman and find out what that means for the banks, who obviously lend a lot of money to the property business. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm good, thanks, John. Yeah, not too bad. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. Last week you wrote a big preview of banks' first quarter results, and we're starting to see those trickling through now. So what are we seeing? Are we seeing what we might have expected? Loan impairments, some real trouble in industries like property?
Yeah. I mean, certainly the former. So big thing we kind of flagged, which is not really much of a surprise for investors to look out for in these results, was the level of loan loss provisions, or basically the amount of sort of bad debts which banks are expecting to now be sitting on their balance sheets. And that's really been the headline of the results so far. So we're speaking on Thursday. We've had four of the five very large UK listed banks have already reported, and in all cases that has been the main headline, how much they've had to set aside for loan loss provisions. In turn, that's really knocked their pre-tax profits for the first quarter quite considerably. In HSBC's case, it halved them. In the case of Lloyds, which put out numbers today, it's pretty much decimated all of their profits. And the thing to note is these loan loss provisions were quite a way ahead of what the market had been expecting. That may be because banks are trying to get some of the, you know, the most of the pain out early. It could be that things are just running away from the market, market consensus forecasts already, and this is the beginning of a really, really painful year for bank profitability and their balance sheets.
So what sort of numbers are we talking about, and where is the pain being felt most? What sort of lending are we seeing provisions being put in place against?
We'll start with HSBC, which put out numbers on Monday. They increased their loan loss provisions fivefold to $3 billion, and that was about 73% worse than consensus forecasts had it. Barclays, I mean, proportionally, their loan loss provisions, because they're quite a smaller relative to HSBC, they're a smaller bank. So they put out a £2.1 billion credit impairment charge for bad loans. I mean, that's pretty large. And then today, Lloyds, they booked a £1.4 billion impairment. So in terms of where this is, you know, at the moment where these charges are being taken, it's a mixture of a sort of dimming in the macroeconomic outlook. So banks essentially adjusting their forecasts for the performance of loans over the coming year and years ahead. But mixed in with that, we've got a few sector-specific issues. For example, Barclays has included a £300 million charge related to lower for longer oil prices and the severe pain we're seeing in the oil and gas sector. They're quite heavily exposed to oil and gas relative to the other lenders. So that's perhaps not surprising, though worrying at the same time. Then we've got HSBC, which in one of their impairments was a large, what they described as a large single corporate exposure in Singapore, which you know has kind of widely been interpreted as the bank's exposure to the oil trading firm Hin Leong, which you know is alleged to have disguised some of its losses. So at the moment, it's on one-off big hits and also a general more pessimistic picture for the economic environment in the months ahead.
Okay, so that's interesting. So some of this is fallout from the absolute mayhem we're seeing in the oil market. I mean, Lloyds is more of a UK lender and more of a lender to households, particularly in the form of mortgages. Are we seeing any problems in the mortgage market?
In terms of loan loss provisions, nothing material has been booked there there as of yet. Though, I suppose the nature of mortgage lending is that they are relative to, you know, for example, an oil and gas client. It's a far less risky proposition to begin with. So, we wouldn't be expecting to see major write downs there. That said, I mean, the guidance, one of those quite striking things there is that the guidance on things like mortgages has been pretty thin so far this week, when you would suppose that they are modelling for some quite serious loan loss provisions, just given the sheer scale of the economic hit to just ordinary mortgage borrowers. So that is an unanswered question at present, though. I mean, we're only a month and a bit into the real crisis. So we may be only talking about one or two mortgage payments deferred as of yet. So it's quite hard to know what the potential impact on that large, particularly UK centric mortgage, those mortgage books is going to look like.
Yeah. So the banks, essentially they have some control over the rate of bad loans in their mortgage books because they can offer people some kind of temporary forbearance.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, UK Finance, which is the trade body for banks and building societies, they say that 1.6 million payment holidays have so far been offered to homeowners impacted by COVID-19. So the majority of those are going to be booked by the likes of RBS, Lloyds and Barclays. And something like 1 in 7 mortgages, it's quite stunning, really, and now in some sort of payment holiday. So that doesn't mean that income is going to disappear forever. It's in most cases it will have been deferred, but at the same time, payment holidays are going to have a negative impact on the sort of the long term effective interest rate earned, and therefore the income that banks can generate. What that quantum is, I mean, at the moment is really anyone's guess.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of dependent upon how long this kind of drags on for. So, you know, payment holidays cannot go on indefinitely.
Yeah.
I guess the banks, like everybody, are hoping for a solution as quickly as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And, but you know, to throw a spanner in all of that, I mean, there's a large question on you know, what happens to the mortgage market if we get a really big shock to house prices. I'd imagine some dent to house prices seems almost inevitable now. At the same time, there is a bit of a cushion in the fact that about 2/3 of the mortgage activity is a product transfer and remortgages. Those markets, you know, could remain fairly robust, and they've even been extended to homeowners who would not normally qualify, such as furloughed workers. So things haven't entirely dried up. First time house purchases are pretty much dead at the moment, but it's not everything that is on ice.
What's the buy-to-let market looking at? I know some of our readers will have buy-to-lets and buy-to-let mortgages. It's been a big sort of line of lending, particularly for some of the challenger banks. What's happening there?
Again, it's very early days, so it's hard to say. But looking at the range of mortgage products out there, a lot of buy-to-let products have been flushed out in recent weeks. I mean, there are some signs that some of these are ticking up. For example, higher loan to value mortgages were down quite considerably at the beginning of April, and there's some signs that is rebounding. More broadly, it looks like the range of buy-to-let products has come down quite considerably. Whether that is an indicator that lenders to those markets are seeing material stresses and concerns about the near-term cash flow viabilities of buy-to-let mortgages is a question that's yet to be determined. I'm sure that would partly be factoring into some of those product cuts. But yeah, again, how that plays out will be a longer term theme for the banks in 2020.
I mean, one of the things we're always interested in when we're looking at the banks is the strengths of their balance sheets, their ability to survive these kind of situations. They obviously went through significant stress tests over the years, but the interest rate has come down, which I guess makes life a lot tougher for them. How are those balance sheets holding up under this intense pressure?
We're only one quarter into the year, so it's quite early days there. On one hand, the sort of enforced decision of the banks to cut their final dividends for 2019 has in a way propped up their capital levels. At the same time, the regulator has said what's called a counter-cyclical buffer, which is an extra chunk of capital which banks are normally required to hold, which is actually going to go up to 2% of their CET1 ratios this year, has been reduced to zero. So in a way, that's good because it means for banks, because they have to hold slightly less capital. But at the same time, there is severe balance sheet, there's severe stress on some of these loans. So risk-weighted assets are going up, and that has the effect of knocking these CET1 sort of regulatory capital levels. So at the moment, I'd say one takeaway from first quarter results is that these don't appear to have been materially tested so far, though investors should definitely expect these to wind down in some cases quite considerably in the coming quarters, not only because of this buffer has been removed, but we're just going to see a lot more pain and provisions, and two, really the income generating capacity of banks has been really hit both by the interest rate cuts and just the lending activity which can be done profitably out there at the moment.
I guess now the big question is, where next for bank shares? I mean, things look pretty tough. We're seeing some results. What's the reaction been? Are they worth holding?
Well, I mean, if you're an income investor, that question may have been answered in the last month as to whether they're worth holding. And for some investors, that was the only reason worth holding the banks, is for their otherwise fairly utility-like reliable dividend streams. In terms of what's next for banks, I would imagine share prices are going to remain under some pressure this year, with one caveat, is that the price to book value ratios of most banks are now at such incredibly depressed levels that in a sense it's harder to see how much lower they can go. And in the case of Barclays, I suppose that's one interesting share, as we noted this week, booking a £2.1 billion credit impairment charge. Never going to be good news, but their shares actually jumped on those results, and that's partly due to their investment banking arm had a pretty good quarter in what was a huge market volatility and a lot of turmoil there. So their trading desks performed quite well, and that has been a sort of bone of contention in one degree for Barclays, because it's a big drain on capital. But it is proved what the chief executive Jess Staley has been saying for some time, in that these having an investment banking arm alongside your more consumer facing arm is actually quite complementary in times of serious stress like those we're seeing. So potentially Barclays of any, I'd say, looks like they offer a little bit of value. But I mean, again, our general view on bank shares is that things are very, very difficult there for any hopes of capital appreciation and, you know, just look at interest rates to get a sense of how easy it is for them to make money.
I know one thing they've been talking about is kind of trimming the cost base a bit. And something that you've spoken about is actually a lot of their cost base is a property base, as we've just discussed with Emma. You know, people are working at home more. Yeah, how much, I mean, is there really much scope for them to really save the kind of amounts of money that they need to through kind of working differently, closing branches, becoming more digital?
Yeah, and I mean, it's a good question. And it's a question they've been trying to answer with limited success over the last few years. You know, as lots of listeners will obviously know, I mean, banks are generally, with a couple of exceptions, cutting their branches as much as they can, because that is one of the areas where they've been able to cut costs easily. One interesting question from the current pandemic and the sort of enforced move for lots of banking customers online. I mean, digital bank app downloads are said to be, you know, at all-time highs in the last month, is whether this can all act as a sort of an accelerator to actually move increasingly online. Yeah, I mean, how and when they do that is a question that is likely to play out over the next couple of years. But that is one area which you might have a bit of optimism if you are a bank investor, in that actually they now have a sort of mandate to cut a bit more from their cost base than they previously were angling for. Also, I mean, the working from home experiment, I mean, it's been quite noticeable from these results, but the praise that chief executives have given on how efficient the transition has often been for working from home operations. If that works now, then there should be questions inevitably on whether some of those savings can be carried forward once hopefully things get better.
Yeah, I mean, banks have big call centres, and you know, one area where I've already seen there being sort of discussions of a permanent transition is actually moving call centre operatives into home. So yeah, you could imagine there's some big savings there.
Absolutely, yeah.
Brilliant. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, John.
The Investment Hour.
So now I'm going over to Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
Yeah, I'm all right. Thank you, John.
All right. You enjoying yourself at the moment? Enjoying the markets this week? That's a no, by the way. There was a loaded question. I can see Phil's face on our Zoom.
I would be enjoying them if they bared any resemblance to reality.
Yeah, well, that's the subject of my column this week in the magazine. I think we all know that markets are doing funny things at the moment. There's some funny reasons for that. Having said that, one of the things that's doing well on the markets is technology companies. Before we start talking about the nature of revenue and why sales are perhaps more than vanity, as the old saying suggests, let's talk about technology, because it's come up in your Alpha report this week as part of this, of how we might adapt to a changed world after COVID. We were chatting on Twitter with some guys at the weekend about this. What's your take on all this, Phil?
I think the world will change after this. I think like many sort of big events in life and in the world, they get us to look at things in a different way. And humans are very good at adapting and changing to what life throws at them. And it's one of the reasons why I think as a race we've survived and prospered for so long. You know, we get into a routine that we stick with for years and years and years. And something comes along and upsets that, and we do something different. And we think, actually, this works quite well. And I think we are going through one of those moments now. And I think a lot of the things that we're all doing now, we will do more of. And that has a lot of implications for, you know, what you and I talk about every week.
Yeah, so one of those things is working from home. And that's something that you do quite a lot that I'm not so used to doing. And I think in your report you say something like, you know, this is what we're all going to get used to, and it's actually going to change a lot of behaviours in the way we work, and that could actually have some impact on productivity even. Now I am actually kind of struggling with working from home right now. Tell me how to get used to it, Phil, and why this might change behaviours in the office.
Well, I think it's fair to say that, you know, we are probably quite fortunate that we have a job that we can work from home. I mean, lots of people don't have those kind, you know, if you work in a factory, you can't work at home, things like that. So But there are, you know, I've always held the view that there are lots of people getting in cars in the morning, getting on busy trains and buses to go and sit at a desk. And when they get there, they get lots of distractions and they don't get a lot of work done. And I think what will have been very revealing to a lot of employers over the last 4 to 5 weeks is how much work people actually do, rather than how much time they actually spend in the office. And I've always been of the view, well, not always, but certainly for the last 15, 20 years, that one of the reasons we have a huge productivity problem in this country, people go on about British productivity. Well, because the large reason for this, in my opinion, very simple view, is that we have managers and companies that manage inputs, not outputs. So they look at how long people spend in the office. We have this culture of presenteeism where no one dare leave the office before 5 o'clock or 5:30 because they will be called a shirker. But actually, no one actually looking at what these people are actually producing. You know, as I say, you know, I can put my cat on a chair for 10 or 12 hours a day. He'll sit in the office quite happily, and he'll do as much work as a lot of people in offices have been getting away with for years.
That did make me laugh, that line.
Yeah, and it's like, but it's like, you know, there's no, you know, in some jobs, you know, this job that we do, writing, I mean, it is a productivity job. It is an output job. And if you fall short, then your editor knows about it very quickly. And so, I mean, in that way, it's quite useful to measure output. But I think productivity from working from home can go up. There is a skill to working from home. You have to have the right setup. And I've been doing this for a large part of the last 10 years. But you have to be very disciplined to do it. You have to be very focused. You have to be very structured. But when you are free of the distractions, it is amazing how much work you can get done. I couldn't do my job for you working in the FT offices. Couldn't do it. Too many distractions. And plus, I think, you know, I probably like to talk too much because I don't get out very often. But I just couldn't do it. I need that time to focus and do it. And I think the combination of working at home, it takes a bit of getting used to. It takes time to sort of put a strategy together. But once you get it, you can be incredibly productive. And that's good for everyone.
Yeah, I don't think I've found a strategy yet. But then we were sort of thrown into this, really, without having had a lot of time to think about how we work from home. You know, we literally reinvented the way we put the magazine together in the space of a week. And yeah, I think you mentioned on Twitter, you know, you can put the magazine together from your kitchen table, but it is difficult. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of, to make this work properly, it's not just the change that's forced upon us, but there has to be some change that we now manage to make it work properly.
And it's not just that, though. It's the fact that we have the technology and the software that enables us to do that. So you have an internet connection, and then software and stuff on the internet that you use. If we didn't have that, we can't do it. But I think what a lot of people have learned is that actually a lot of the stuff that is on there is very good. I mean, we're doing it now. We are having a conversation remotely.
Yeah, I think it could get better, though. And I think, you know, what we've discovered. So, yes, this technology is amazing and it's allowing us to do things that we couldn't do before. But it needs refining. If this is to become the new normal, then this technology needs to be improved in specific ways that actually work for, you know, for our specific function, putting a magazine together. You know, that's we're cobbling together our solution with lots of bits of technology like Slack and Zoom and Hangouts and whatever else, instant messaging. We need something that works for us a bit better. You know, and I also think, you know, the discipline is that has to be managed as well. You know, you talk about distractions, but there's lots of digital distractions too. I think there's a lot of pros and cons here. But nevertheless, it's translating into fantastic business for the tech companies. And, you know, they're absolutely flying. I know Microsoft is a big favourite of yours. Wrote about it extensively recently. Had some results yesterday into the Fantasy SIP.
Yeah, no, I just think, you know, there's nothing undiscovered about Microsoft. You know, it's one of the biggest companies in the world. It's been around for years. And people know its products very well, or most of its products very well. But it seems perfectly set up now. I mean, I'm struggling to think of a company that is actually better placed to exploit this kind of remote working than Microsoft, because if you look at what it's got, it has the cloud, you know, it's got its cloud infrastructure, it's got its servers, it's got its software. So it's got its office software. So you've got your productivity there, you've got your Microsoft Teams for your meetings. You've then got the Dynamics business, which is like a business management software where people can actually run their businesses, and that's linked into the cloud. So they've got all these bits and bobs that go together along, you know, they've got the software which enables it, and then they've got the infrastructure, which is what you need. And together, it's a fantastic package of products. And we saw yesterday, you know, we saw the results yesterday in their third quarter results. And bear in mind here, the company's results were from beginning of January until the end of March. So what happened with the lockdown and the virus had virtually no impact on these results at all. And the revenues were up 15%, and the profits are up 25%. And, you know, the bits that benefit from the lockdown, so the cloud stuff, is doing better than, say, what loses. So all the cloud stuff and the software and the office, that benefits in a big way. What loses is things like advertising revenue on LinkedIn, a lot of job losses. You lose a lot of advertising revenue. You lose advertising revenue on Bing, the search engine. And of course, if businesses are buying fewer computers, that means that there is fewer copies of Microsoft Windows getting installed on them. But thankfully for Microsoft, those aren't the key drivers of its business. And it's just a really, really good business. And it, you know, it's not cheap. You know, it trades on about 29 times trailing 12-month earnings. But, you know, do you have confidence that in 5-10 years' time, this selection of technologies that they have is going to be used by more people? Well, I do. And, you know, the ability to grow probably means that these shares are a good long-term bet.
Mm. Absolutely. I mean, the other thing you mentioned in your Alpha report, and, you know, this is something that we often experience when we're on these video calls, is the quality of the UK's broadband network. So some of my colleagues quite clearly have very bad broadband connections. Mine's okay. Yours is decent, not as good as mine.
Mine
is BT. It's really decent. Fibre to cabinet.
Okay.
But I think it could be better. It feels to me like this is an area where the UK needs quite significant investment. Getting this broadband infrastructure absolutely firing.
I agree. I think BT has been trying to do broadband on the cheap in this country. It's been, to be fair to it, it's actually done quite a good job of squeezing quite fast speeds out of the old copper network, but it can't do that. It can't really do that anymore. And you know, the fibre to the cabinet's okay if you don't live too far from the cabinet. And if, you know, I don't know, I've not experienced any problems. But then again, you know, I've got teenage son upstairs who's gaming and stuff, and I've probably got the same sort of fibre as you've got, and it works okay. But we're only 250 meters from the cabinet. I think if we were a mile from the cabinet, it might be a different story. But yeah, you know, it's going to take billions to upgrade this. But, you know, for me, I would much rather see tens of billions spent on this than a fast train line out of London to the north of England, you know?
Yeah, it certainly could change those government spending priorities. I mean, you know, I haven't been on a train for God knows how long. And that's something you also talk about in the Alpha report. You know, we're going to need to commute less. This is going to have an impact on rail operators. It's going to have an impact on the people providing office space, which you've already talked about on this podcast. But yeah, I mean, there was talk maybe 4 weeks ago when we started talking about permanent changes in behaviour that actually we were getting ahead of ourselves. But actually, the more we do this, the likelier it seems that some of these changes are going to stick, and that some industries like rail and travel and property have got some pretty big challenges ahead.
I agree. I mean, I thought it was very interesting yesterday that the chief executive of Barclays came out and just said the era of big offices is over. If businesses like Barclays are saying that, then, you know, they're not going to be the only one. I think it has a big implications for commercial property, particularly in big cities like London, potentially even has implications for residential property as well, because if the infrastructure is there, then, you know, people can, you know, move to cheaper areas of the country and still do their jobs. Maybe get on a train once a week and go to the office once a week and keep in touch.
I mean, I did that. I moved to a place that isn't on a train line. You know, I took it on the chin that I have to drive to the station every day, and it is a right pain. It's a right pain. And now I think I can do that much less. This is great. And, you know, take my house and put it in London. I dread to think what I'd pay.
Well, I did 10 years of, you know, getting up at 5:30 and commuting and coming back at 7 o'clock, and it kills you. You know, it's just wasted time. Never mind the effect it has on your health and well-being. So I think there's a lot of positives from this, a lot of potential positives. Yes, there will be some losers. What it needs, though, it needs the management of companies to embrace this, and above all else, to trust their employees, because a lot of working from home is down to trust. But it also comes down to what I was saying right at the beginning, is that if you measure employees, or if you can, I appreciate that some jobs are easier to do this than others, but if you can actually just measure people on what they produce rather than how long they sit there, and you trust them to get on with it, then this can work. I mean, if you're a boss and you can't trust someone to work from home, you've got to ask yourself, why are you employing them in the first place? But this is what it needs for a buy-in. And, you know, if the whole thing about working 9 to 5 as well, I think potentially could change. I think the flexibility, as long as the job gets done by a certain time, give people the freedom, empower people, just judge them on what they produce. And this thing can work, and it can have massive positive benefits for society, the economy. And it's, you know, something that I've been passionate about for a long time, because I do it. You know, I'm talking my own book here, but I feel that it works for me. I think every employer I work for hopefully thinks it's worked for them. I haven't let them down. And I want to see more of it. And I hope that this could be one of the good things that comes out of all of this.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I think the trust thing is really interesting. You know, I think that certainly the staff of the Investors Chronicle have proved that they can be very much trusted. You know, the thing I can't trust them to do is stop working. You know, people are putting in stupid hours to get this thing out. And that does worry me. So actually, I think the trust thing is kind of flipped in some ways. You know, we have to trust managers and the people running companies not to take advantage of their staff home working and the extra productivity that brings. I think the trust thing has flipped, and perhaps even the power dynamic in companies can flip as a result of this, which I don't see as a bad thing at all.
No, I don't either. It just needs to be, you know, I think, you know, if someone's put in a shift to get a magazine out, let them have the next day off. You know, if they've done the job. I think there's been, you know, I don't want to sound like some militant trade unionist from the 1970s, but I think this whole thing about, you know, one of the things about productivity is that, you know, obviously we're not going back to piecework, but productive workers lose out because they get paid, if they're doing the same job as somebody who's unproductive, they get paid the same wage, and sometimes they can be doing twice the amount of work. And what should actually be happening is they should be getting Thursday and Friday off. You know, if the employer, but what the employer's getting is a load of free labor. He's getting a load of free labor from one person. He's getting a load of expensive labor from the other. And I think it needs a complete change in outlook. But I think the things about the productivity puzzle in the UK, I mean, it's a difficult thing anyway. I mean, how on earth do you measure this for lots of things? It's almost a ridiculous thing. But it, you know, the amount of work done, if you can measure it, you know. I think that it's like part-time workers. You know, I've seen a lot of part-time workers produce as much work as full-time workers do for half the money. And what I think one of the biggest problems that we've had in the economy for the last 30 or 40 years is that labour workers have actually not got a fair cut of the cake, in that a lot of the benefits of production have accrued not to the workers. You can argue that 40, 50 years ago, the balance was completely the other way. And now the pendulum has probably swung too far in favour of businesses.
Well, in favour of maybe shareholders or executives excessive executive pay.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that, you know, if you want to get in, you know, what if you look at what the central bankers are going on at the moment. Central bankers are petrified of falling prices. They are petrified of deflation. Well, I'll tell you one way you can solve deflation is just pay workers a bit more cash, because they'll go and spend it. Prices will go up. That's one of the easiest ways to, if you're worried about deflation, that is one way that you can do it. But I don't want to get all political here, but I do think that it's one of the big problems in terms of things like inequality. It's amazing how a lot of these problems that people talk about in the world, often they all meet at the same roundabout.
This is definitely a very interesting roundabout.
It is a very interesting roundabout.
It is. It's extraordinary. Should we spend a few minutes talking about your magazine column, Phil? Okay. Which is interesting. So I introduced this by saying, you know, there is this old phrase, sales are vanity, profit is sanity. But there's a bit of a nuance that you explore in your piece this week. Talk us through it.
Well, I think the thing is, you know, just getting really back to basics, is that if you haven't got any sales, if a company hasn't got any revenues, I prefer the word sales, actually. I always think sales is a better word than revenues.
But why?
Because it just what I was brought up with, you know, it's what, you know, you make a sale. You know, I've made a sale today. I've sold something to somebody. It's a sale.
Yeah, we generate revenues these days, Phil. We generate revenues.
I know, we do. But it's, you know, pretty much the same thing. They're the lifeblood of any business. Without it, you are not going to survive very long, and you are certainly not going to prosper long-term if you don't grow those revenues. What's a really interesting exercise, and this is what I've done this week, is you just actually start with these basic sales and just start looking at a company's revenues. And it is absolutely amazing what you can learn about a business. And all this information's pretty much in like the annual report or on the investors' presentations. And, you know, just start with the basics, such as where does the company get its revenues from?
Sales, Phil. Sales.
Sales, yeah. Where does it get its revenue? We'll talk about revenues. Where does it get its revenues from? You know, who are its customers? What's the nature of those revenues? You know, are they contracted? Are they expensive items? Are they things that people buy every day? All these are the things that you can find out. And it's often people just gloss over these kind of things. You know, it's a number. Oh, I'll move on to the next number. I'm more interested in the profit. And then, you know, you can then start, you know, analyzing things like, you know, whether the sales change over time, has it, you know, how the makeup of a company's revenues has changed over time. Very simple things like, you know, are they seasonal? You know, does this company rely on making a large chunk of its sales or revenue, at Christmas or in the summer or one particular time of year? And knowing that is very important, because you know if it's a wet summer or it's a poor Christmas, that the profits for that company are not going to be good for that year. And then you can, you know, you start off with the basics and you can learn a lot. And then, you know, depending on what kind of information the company gives, you can really start drilling down and looking at how companies are changing. And I've talked about this in the article about, you know, how you can analyze a company's like-for-like revenues and how you can get the numbers that the companies tell you over the years. And then you can actually work between. So say for example, that company gives you a trading update after 10 weeks and tells you what the sales were for the first 10 weeks, then gives you one for 20 weeks and say, oh, for the first 20 weeks of this, doesn't tell you what they were in between, but you can work it out. And then you can then work out, you know, the momentum, the changing, and you can spot subtle changes in revenues that perhaps people who just read the statement and just take the number at face value will miss.
Like for likes are something that we see a lot in the retail industry, because you can open new stores and that will boost your sales, or you can buy in revenue and that will boost your sales. So like for likes are important because they give us the sort of consistent picture.
Yeah, so in very simple terms, if you've got a shop, it'll tell you what that shop is doing. So, you know, if you're a retailer, you have shops and you can grow your sales by opening more shops or selling more from your existing shops. And what you really want to see is that you look about the quality of the revenue growth. And if you've got your existing shop selling more stuff, that's usually a better sign of company health than one that's just growing by opening up shops. And I talk about, I won't go into it and complicate, but I talk about, you know, some of the effects that can sort of make like-for-like sales a bit murky when you've got lots of shops opening up over a number of years because they're all getting up to speed and they can distort the like-for-like sales figure. But people can read the article and get into that. And then, you know, you can also spot things, you know, you can spot things going wrong. You know, when, you know, we've had a number of circumstances in the last 5 or 6 years of very high profile, high growth retailers or restaurant companies that just run out of growth and they open up too many bars or too many restaurants and they start taking sales from themselves. Something called sales cannibalization. And then you can get into things like, you know, the difference between selling volume and prices. You know, you can grow your sales either by selling more or putting the prices up, or a combination of the two.
The example we give here is Unilever.
Yeah.
And, you know, a big criticism of Unilever over the years is that it's grown through price increases.
Yeah.
And I guess the danger of that is that you reach the limit to which consumers will accept those price increases.
Yeah, and it's often a sign of a business that's in trouble, or a business that perhaps is abusing its position. A classic example of this was, you know, this was Sainsbury's in the late 1980s, right? If you were to look at sort of Sainsbury's in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and you were to go and study its accounts, you pretty much knew that a large chunk or virtually all of its sales growth was coming from putting its prices up, and it became too expensive, and Tesco came along and ate its lunch. I mean, there were other reasons for that, but I think Marks and Spencer has done that. I think companies like John Lewis are perhaps guilty of that, or have been guilty of that. And it's about, you know, not taking your customers for granted. You know, you might think that, you know, people talk about pricing power. Yeah, they want to see pricing power, and they see that as a sign of strength. It's often a sign of weakness, because you are taking you're abusing your customer base, and you are then potentially attracting new entrants to come and take your business away from them. So understanding what you want to see is companies grow by volume. And probably one of the best examples of company growing by volume is Amazon. So Amazon cuts prices, grows volume that way. And so again, trying to understand that if you can. I mean, some companies don't tell you that, but if companies do tell you that, then spending some time looking at that is a good thing. And then the other thing, I mean, which is a bit more advanced, is, you know, looking at how a company drives its sales. And, you know, one of the ways that companies can drive sales is by selling on credit. And there's lots of ways that you can check the quality of a company's credit, you know, looking at bad debts, looking at debts that are overdue and that kind of thing. So the whole purpose of the article was to actually just show the reader that this very sort of simple top line number that we all look at, there is huge amounts of information that stem from it. And if you take the time to actually look into it, you can learn huge amounts of valuable information and insight into a company's business.
The one we're always looking for, certainly with sort of software companies like Microsoft, is this recurring revenue idea. So where you've basically got subscription businesses where you're locking people in to long-term contracts. It's a very valuable and powerful source of revenue. And the thing we also look for as a potential pitfall is companies that get their revenue from too few customers. So yeah, we would rather be seeing companies that are making lots of small amounts of revenue from hundreds and hundreds and thousands of customers rather than making most of their revenue from one big customer.
Yeah, or a product.
Or one product, exactly, which can perhaps be superseded. I mean, it is fascinating. It's really interesting. And definitely something that investors should pay more attention to. Did you like Next's update, by the way, this week? Did you have a look at it? I mean, necessarily the substance, but the presentation. I thought it was a beautiful thing in terms of corporate reporting.
It always is. And I think sometimes we have to look a bit behind that now. I think this is, without wishing to be a little bit of a damp squib on this, I think, you know, it is, and hats off to them. I mean, I've said this before, we've said it before, other people have said it. Great example of communication with investors. You know, they always give you a profit forecast, or most of the time they give you, you know, they're completely as open as I think they probably can be without telling their competitors what they're buying clothes for. You know, it's very good. I still think, you know, Next is, sweep this aside, you know, I haven't changed my view. I think Next is, you know, it's one of the better retailers out there. But it's going to be hard for this company to grow. I really do think it's going to be hard for this company to grow, even when we get back into a normal world. Because what seems to be happening is that its sales are migrating from its stores onto the internet, and there isn't actually a lot of growth in this business. There's a very big reliance, again, we just talked about credit. Very, very big reliance on credit here as well in the Next business. And I thought one of the interesting things, they alluded to the fact that they expect their credit customers, particularly which is mainly in the online business, I mean, they still have store cards as well, to take a bit longer to pay off their balances. And they also expect some defaults, but they didn't actually quantify the defaults. And I think one of the big risks to this business, I mean, it's interesting, they were going to rein back their credit lending as well, for obvious reasons. But I think the thing that I was sort of left pondering after looking at Next was, you know, what the bad debt situation could be at this company. They do disclose it's about 40-50 million a year, actually.
Yeah, something to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you, Phil. Enjoy the weekend.
Yeah, you too.
We'll speak again next week.
Yeah.
Thanks, Phil.
All right, cheers.
Sadly, that is all we have time for this week. But before we go, let me just talk you through what else we have in this week's mag, which is now, in fact, the seventh magazine that we have produced from our kitchens, lounges and bedrooms. Alongside Phil in the comments section, we have the usual insights, observations and share ideas from Chris Dillo, Mr. Bearable, Simon Thompson and Michael Taylor, who thinks there's a bit more juice to be squeezed out of the oil market, specifically the US tanker sector. And we've also looked at how to mitigate the oil market mayhem in this week's fun section. Make sure you tune into the PF podcast, which we will be recording later. As well as starring in several of our webinars this week, Algie Hall has been on the hunt for growth at a reasonable price in this week's stock screen. It's slim pickings at the moment, I'm afraid, but he's found an unlikely candidate that ticks all the right boxes. We have a few results, including the reappearance of our old friend Burford Capital, a Marmite stock if ever there was one, and the horrible trading updates and profit warnings that we may have expected are starting to flow thick and fast now, and you'll find them scattered throughout the magazine. A cratering economy does potentially mean an uptick in business for one sector, those involved in dealing with insolvencies, which we've looked at in depth. And Algie Hall has also written the cover feature, looking at how some of the best fund managers boost their returns by focusing on a few good ideas. An approach we'll be looking at in more detail in the magazine in coming issues. Watch this space. We have some interesting developments coming very soon. So, thank you all for listening, and thank you to all of our guests, Emma, Alex and Phil, and of course to Megan. Pick up the magazine. In all good news agents, follow the leader. Why it pays to track the best ideas from the best fund managers. Or if you're still stuck indoors, get onto the internet and subscribe. Take care and speak soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.